Chapter 6.
"It would be only with the greatest reluctance that I should consent to leave you," said Stephen, sitting there in the Franklin's cabin.
"It is most obliging of you to say so," replied Jack, with a hint of testiness, "and I take it very kindly. But we have been through this many times, and once again I am obliged to point out that you have no choice in the matter. You must go into Callao with the others as soon as everything is ready."
"I do not like your eye, and I do not like your leg," said Stephen. "As for the scalp wound, though spectacular, it is of no great consequence. I dare say it will hurt for some weeks, and your hair will go white for an inch or two on either side. But I do not think you need fear any complications."
"It still makes me stupid and fretful at times," said Jack, and then with a slightly false air of one who is deliberately changing the subject, "Stephen, should Sam come aboard, of course it is very unlikely, why should he indeed or even still be in Peru, but should he come aboard, pray give him my love, tell him that I hope to bring the Franklin in, and that we should be very happy if he would dine with us. And for the moment, I mean if he should come, which I doubt, please ask him what we can do with the blacks we took in Alistair. They are not seamen in any sense of the term, and they are really no use to us at all. But they were slaves, and Peru is a slave country, so I do not like to put them ashore where they may be seized and sold. I particularly dislike it since, having been aboard an English ship, they are now, as I understand it, free men. Quite how this squares with the slave trade I cannot tell, but that is how I understand the law."
"Sure, you are right. There was a case in Naples where some slaves came aboard a man of war and wrapped themselves in the ensign. They were never given up. And in any case, government abolished the trade in the year 7. The law may be disobeyed, slavers may still sail, but they do so illegally, since government certainly abolished the vile traffic."
"Did they indeed? I was not aware. Where were we in the year 7?
He pondered for a while on the year 7, tracing back voyage after voyage, and then he said,
"By the by, I am sending in the Frenchmen who do not choose to carry on with us, and who are not seamanlike enough for us to keep. I promised to pay them off in Callao, you remember. And now I come to think of it, there is one in this ship."
They were sitting in the cabin of the Franklin, to which Jack had removed,
"who was an apothecary's assistant in New Orleans. He wished to stay, and he might be of some use to you, short-handed as you are. Martin found him quite helpful, I believe."
"Then you must certainly keep him," said Stephen.
"No,"
said Jack in a determined voice.
"Killick has looked after me, under your orders, ever since before the peace. This man's name is Fabian. I shall send him over."
Stephen knew that argument would be useless. He said nothing, and Jack went on.
"I shall be sending a whole parcel of them over, those who wish to go."
"You would never be sending Dutour, after all," cried Stephen.
"I had thought of doing so, yes," said Jack. "He sent me a polite little note asking leave to make his adieus, thanking us for our kindness and undertaking not to serve again."
"From my point of view, it might be impolitic," said Stephen.
Jack looked at him, saw that the matter had to do with intelligence, and nodded.
"Are there any others you would object to?" he asked. "Adams will show you a list."
"Never a one, my dear," said Stephen, and he looked at the opening door.
"If you please, sir," said Reed. "Captain Pulling sends his compliments, and all is laid along."
"The doctor will be with you directly,"
said Captain Aubrey.
"In 5 minutes," said Dr. Maturin.
He lifted the bandage over Jack's eye. He looked at the pike wound.
"You must swear by Sophie's head to suffer Killick to dress both these places with their respective lotions and pomades before breakfast, before dinner, and before retiring. I have given him precise instructions. Swear."
"I swear,"
said Jack, holding up his right hand.
"He will grow absolutely insupportable, as usual. And, Stephen, pray give Martin my most particular compliments. It was noble of him to try to come on deck to bury our people. I've never seen a man look so like death. Gaunt, grey, sunken. He could barely stand."
"It was not only weakness. He has lost his sense of balance entirely. I do not think he will regain it. He must leave the sea."
"So you told me. Leave the sea. Poor fellow. Poor fellow. But I quite understand, and he must certainly go home. Now, brother, your boat has been hooked on this age. You will be much better by yourself for a while. I'm afraid I have been like a bear in a whore's bed these last few days."
"Not at all, not at all. Quite the reverse."
As for Dutor, Adams will reply to his note saying it is regretted his request cannot be complied with, and he is required to remain aboard the Franklin. Compliments, of course, and a civil word about accommodation. And, Stephen, one last word. Have you any notion of how long your business will keep you on shore? Forgive me if I am indiscreet.
If it is not over in a month, it will not be over at all, said Stephen, but I will leave word in the ship. God bless now.
The ships were not to part until the sun was low, in the first place because Captain Aubrey had to speak at some length to the other commanders and redistribute the crews, and in the second because he wished to deceive a remote sail on the western horizon, a potential quarry. He intended this distant ship to suppose that an unhurried convoy slowly heading east by south, often peaceably gossiping alongside, would carry straight on to Callao, and he did not intend to make the signal to part company until the strangers to gallants were out of sight, even from the main jack cross-trees. Long before this time, however, Dr. Maturin had to attend to his duties as the frigate's surgeon. Having regained the surprise, he stood for a while at the taffrail, looking aft along the line of ships. The Alastor, thinly manned but unharmed in masts and rigging and now almost clean, the Whaler in much the same case, and the Franklin, her wounded bowsprit now repaired with spars from the foremaster. A fine array of yards and canvas, and the kind of tale that had so often followed the surprise, that predatory ship, into various ports.
"A big pardon, sir," said Sarah, just behind him, "but Padine says will you be long at all?"
After a moment she tugged his coat and, speaking rather louder, said,
"A big pardon, sir. Padine wonders will you ever be a great while, surely not for the love of God."
"I am with you, child," said Stephen, gathering his wits. "I thought I heard a sea lion bark."
He plunged down to the sick berth, tolerably fetid still in spite of double windsails, although it was not so crowded as it had been in the first few days after the battle, when he could hardly step between his patients, and they laid here and there about the orlop. Padine, his loblolly boy, was as kind and gentle a creature as ever came from Munster, and long use had not blunted his humanity. He was weeping now over a wretched man from the Alastor, who, having fallen out of his cot, was lying there on his shattered arm, wedged under a helpless neighbour, and resisting all attempts at help by clinging with maniac force to a ringbolt. He was indeed out of his mind, not only because of the terrifying end of the battle and the horrible future, but also because his fever had now almost drowned what little reason he had left. However, what Padine's kindness and great, though cautious, strength, and the little girl's expostulation could not do, Dr. Maturin's cool authority accomplished, and with the wretched man restored to his bed, fastened to it, his hopeless wound redressed, Stephen began his long and weary round. There had been few survivors from the Alastor, and of those few, three had already died of their injuries. Most of the rest swore they were prisoners, and certainly they had taken no part in the fight, having crammed themselves unarmed into the manger or the forepeak. All the others were his shipmates, men he had known and liked for many voyages, sometimes for as long as he had been in the navy. Bondon's great cutlass slash, which had called for such anxious sewing, was doing well, but there were cases where he saw the probable necessity for resection, foresaw it, and its dangers, with a grief increased by the seamen's total, unfounded confidence in his powers, and by their gratitude for his treatment. A wearing round, and it should have been followed by his visits forward to the little berths where the warrant officers slept. Mr. Smith, the gunner, was not aboard the Franklin, and Stephen had put Mr. Granger into his place, as more suitable for a wounded man than his official cabin aft. He was on his way there, accompanied by Sarah, carrying basin, lint, bandages, when, as they passed through the checkered shafts of daylight coming down from the deck, they heard the call,
"Signal for parting company, sir!"
and Pulling's reply,
"Acknowledge and salute!"
"Oh, sir," cried Sarah, "may we run up and look?"
"Very well," said Stephen, "but put down your basin and the lint, and walk soberly."
The ships separated with the smooth inevitability of a sea parting, slow at first, still within calling distance, and then, if one's attention were distracted for a few moments by a bird, a floating patch of seaweed, the gap had grown to a mile, and one's friends' faces were no longer to be made out. For with the warm, steady, southerly breeze, ships sailing in opposite directions drew apart at 15 or 16 knots, even with no t'gallants abroad. The Franklin, Captain Aubrey, headed west to cruise upon the enemy until he should hear that the Surprise had been docked and was now fit for a passage of the Horn, that the prizes had been disposed of, and above all that Stephen, having accomplished what he had set out to do, was ready to go home. The Franklin would, he hoped with reasonable confidence, send in prizes from time to time, but in any event he had a fine half-decked schooner-rigged launch belonging to the Alistair that could be dispatched from well out in the offing to fetch stores and news from Callao. The Surprise, Captain Pullings, on the other hand, stood a little south of east for Peru, whose prodigious mountains were already said to be visible from the masthead, and whose strange, cold, north-flowing current was undoubtedly present. And in duty bound her two prizes sailed after her, each at two cables' lengths. The sun set, with the Franklin clear on the horizon, and it left a golden sky of such beauty that Stephen felt a constriction in his throat. Sarah, too, was moved, but she said nothing until they were below again, when she observed, "I shall say 7 Hail Marys every day until we see them again." The boatswain was their first patient. He had gone aboard the Alistair roaring drunk, and there, pursuing a pair of enemies into the maintop, he had fallen, landing in the waist of the ship onto a variety of weapons. He was a mass of cuts and abrasions. Yet it was a great wrench where his leg was caught in the tarpins that kept him from his duty. He was drunk again now, and he endeavoured to disguise his state by saying as little as possible, and that very carefully, and by directing his breath down towards the deck. They dressed his many places, Sarah with something less than her habitual tenderness. She hated drunkenness, and her disapproval filled the little cabin, making the boatswain simper in a nervous, placating manner. And when he was bound up, they parted, Sarah to go back to the sick berth, and Stephen to call on Mr. Granger, who had been brought down by a musket shot. The ball had followed one of those strange, indirect courses, so unlike the path of a rifle bullet, and after a prolonged search Stephen had found it lodged, visibly pulsating, just in contact with the subclavian artery. The wound was healing prettily, and Stephen congratulated Granger on having flesh as clean and sweet as a child's. Yet although the patient smiled and made a handsome acknowledgement of the doctor's care, it was plain that he had something on his mind. "Fadal came over from the Franklin to see me a little while ago," he said, "and he was in a great take-in about Mr. Dutour. He had heard that Mr. D's request to be sent into Callao with the other Frenchmen had been refused. As you know, Fadal and his friends think the world of Mr. Dutour. They admire his sentiments on freedom and equality and no tithes, no interference with worship. Freedom! See how he spoke up for those poor unfortunate blacks out of the Alistair, offering to pay the Jamaica price out of his own pocket for their liberty. Pay it down on the capstan head for the general prize fund."
"Did he indeed?"
"Yes, sir, he did. So Fadal and his relations, most of the Nipper darlings are cousins in some degree or another, are most uneasy at the thought of his being taken back to England, and perhaps taken up before the Admiralty Court on a point of law, and ending up at execution dock hanged for a pirate, just because he did not have a piece of paper." "Mr. Dutour a pirate? It makes no sense, Doctor. Those wicked men in the Alistair were pirates. Not Mr. Dutour. They were the sort of people you see hanging in chains at Tilbury Point, a horrid warning to them as sails by. Not Mr. Dutour, who is a learned man and who loves his fellow beings." Granger's drift was clear enough, and he could not be allowed to reach a direct request. Stephen had the medical man's recourse. During a pause for emphasis, he desired Granger to hold his breath, took his pulse, and having counted it, watch in hand, he said,
"Do you know we parted company an hour ago? I must go and tell Mr. Martin. With this breeze, I understand we should be in quite soon, and I should like to set him on dry land as early as possible."
"Parted company so soon?" cried Granger. "I never knew. Nor did Fadal when he spoke to me this morning." Then recovering himself, "Mr. Martin, of course. Pray give the poor gentleman my kind good day. We were right moved to hear he had to creep on deck to bury our shipmates."
"Nathaniel Martin," said Stephen, "I am sorry to have left you so long untended."
"Not at all, not at all," cried Martin. "That good Perdine has been by. Emily brought me a cup of tea, and I have slept much of the time. I am indeed very much better."
"So I see," said Stephen, bringing his lantern down to look into Martin's face. He then turned back the sheet. "The disorders of the skin,"
he observed, gently feeling the ugliest lesion, are perhaps the most puzzling in all medicine. Here is a sensible diminution within hours.
I slept as I have not slept for heaven knows how long, my body lying peacefully at last. No incessant irritation, no pain from the slightest pressure, no perpetual turning in vain for ease.
There is nothing to be done without sleep, said Stephen, and he continued with his examination. Yet, said he, replacing the sheet, I shall be glad to set you on shore. Your skin may well be on the mend, but I am not at all satisfied with your heart or your lungs or your elimination, and from what you tell me the vertigo is as bad as ever, even worse. Firm land underfoot may do wonders, and a vegetable diet. The same is to be said for several of our patients.
And we have so often known it to be the case, said Martin.
In parenthesis, may I tell you a strange thing? Some hours ago, as I was coming out of a blessed doze, I thought I heard a sea lion bark, and my heart lifted with happiness, as it did when I was a boy, or even in New South Wales. How close are we to the shore? I cannot tell. But they said, before we parted company, for the captain is standing to the westward, he leaves you his particular compliments, that the Cordillera was distinctly to be seen from the masthead. And there may well be some rocky islands close at hand where sea lions live. For my own part, I have seen a file of pelicans. They are not birds to go far from land.
Very true. But pray tell me about the present state of the sick berth. I am afraid you have been cruelly overworked.
They talked for a while about the recent incised, lacerated, punctured, and gunshot wounds, the fractures simple, compound, or comminuted that had come below, and Stephen's success or failure in dealing with them, speaking in an objective, professional manner. In a less detached tone, Martin asked after the captain.
"It is the eye that troubles me," said Stephen. "The pike thrust is healing by first intention. The head wound, though its stunning effect is still evident to a slight degree, is of no consequence, nor is the loss of blood. But the eye received the wad of the pistol bullet that tore his scalp, a thick, gritty, partially disintegrated wad. I extracted many fragments, and I believe there was no grave scoring of the cornea, nor, of course, any penetration. But there is great and persistent hyperemia and lacrimation."
He was about to say that such a patient was not to be relied upon, would double doses, would swallow them together with any quack panacea, would listen to the first cowleech he might encounter. But he restrained himself, and their conversation returned to the sick berth as Martin had left it, to their old patients.
"And how are Grant and Macduff?" asked Martin.
"Those who had the Vienna treatment? Grant died just before the action, and clearly I did not have time to open him, but I strongly suspect the corrosive sublimate. Macduff is well enough for light duties, though his constitution is much shattered. I doubt his full recovery."
After a pause, and in an altered voice, Martin said,
"I must tell you that I, too, took the Vienna treatment."
"In what dose?"
"I could find nothing in our authorities, so I based myself on the amount we used for our calomel draughts."
Stephen said nothing. The bolder Austrian physicians might administer a quarter of a grain of the sublimate. The usual dose of calomel was 4.
"Perhaps I was rash," said Martin, "but I was desperate, and the calomel and guaiacum seemed to do no good."
"They could not cure a disease you did not have," said Stephen. "But in any event, I shall be glad to have you in hospital, where you can, with something like decency and comfort, be purged and purged again. We must do everything possible to rid your system of this noxious substance."
"I was desperate," said Martin, his mind fixed on that dreadful past. "I was unclean, unclean, rotting alive, as the seamen say, a shameful death. And I think my mind was disturbed. Until you absolutely asserted that these were salt sores, I was wholly convinced that they were of sinful origin. You will admit they were very like." "They were very like, were they not?"
"When they had been exacerbated by an immoderate use of mercury, perhaps they were, though I doubt an impartial observer would have been deceived."
"The wicked fleeth where no man pursueth," said Martin. "Dear Maturin, I have been a very wicked fellow. In intention, I have been a very wicked fellow.
You might spend the night in drinking fresh rainwater, said Stephen. Every time you wake, you must swallow down a glass at least to get rid of all you can. Padine will bring you a rack of necessary bottles, and I trust I shall see them filled by morning. But I cannot wait to get you ashore and to start more radical measures, for indeed, colleague, there is not a moment to lose.
There was not a moment to lose, and happily the harbour formalities in Callao Bay did not take long, the surprise and her valuable train being so welcome to the agent, who had dealt with her prizes on the outward voyage, and to his brother, the captain of the port. As soon as they were over, Stephen went ashore, pulled by Jemmy Ducks in his little skiff. Well over on the left hand, they passed a remarkable amount of shipping for so small a town, vessels from Chile, Mexico, and further north, and at least two China ships.
"Right on our beam, beyond the yellow schooner, in the dockyard itself. That must be the barque from Liverpool," said Jemmy. "They're busy in her tops."
It was high tide on the dusty strand, and as Stephen walked up it towards an archway in the wall, a gritty cloud swept across from the earthquake-shattered ruins of old Callao. When it had cleared, he saw a group of ill-looking men of all colours, from black to dirty yellow, standing under the shelter.
"Gentlemen," he said in Spanish, "pray do me the kindness of pointing out the hospital."
"Your worship will find it next to the Dominican church," said a brown man. "Sir, sir, it is just before Joselito's warehouse," cried a black.
"Come with me," said a third.
He led Stephen through the tunnel into an immense unpaved square with dust whirling in eddies about it.
"There is the governor's house," he said, pointing back to the seaward end of the square. "It is shut. On the right hand," he went on, holding out his left, "your worship has the viceroy's palace. It too is closed."
They turned. In the middle of the square, three black-and-white vulturine scavengers with a wingspan of about 6 feet were disputing the dried remains of a cat.
"What do you call those?" asked Stephen.
"Those," replied his guide, looking at them with narrowed eyes. "Those are what we call birds, your worship. And there, before Joselito's warehouse, is the hospital itself."
Stephen looked at it with some concern. A low building with very small barred windows, the flat mud roof barely a hand's reach from the filthy ground. Prudent, no doubt, in a country so subject to earthquakes, but as a hospital it left to be desired.
"The hospital, with 100 people at the least, lying on beds raised a good span from the ground. And there I see a vile heretic coming out of it, with his countryman."
"Which? The little, small, fat, yellow-haired gentleman who staggers so?"
"No, no, no. He is an old and mellow Christian. Your Honour, too, is an old and mellow Christian, no doubt."
"None older, few more mellow."
"A Christian, though English. He is a great lawyer come to lecture the University of Lima on the British Constitution. His name is Raleigh, Don Curtius Raleigh. You have heard of him. He is drunk. I must run and fetch his coach."
"He has fallen."
"Clearly. It is the tall, black-haired villain who is picking him up, the surgeon of the Liverpool ship. That is the heretic. I must run."
"Do not let me detain you, sir. Pray accept this trifle."
"God will repay your worship. Farewell, sir. May no new thing arise."
"May no new thing arise," replied Stephen.
With his pocket spyglass, he watched the birds for a while, their name hovering on the edge of his mind. Presently, as Don Curtius's coach rolled into the square, silent on the dust, they flew off, one carrying the desiccated cat and the other snatching at it. They flew inland towards Lima, a splendid-looking white-towered city 5 or 6 miles away, with an infinitely more splendid series of mountains behind it, rising higher and higher in the distance, their snow at last blending with the white sky and the clouds. The carriage rolled away, drawn by 6 mules, Don Curtius singing Greensleeves. Stephen approached the remaining Englishman, took off his hat, and said,
"Francis Geary, a very good day to you, sir."
"Stephen Maturin, I thought for a moment it looked like you, but my spectacles are covered with dust."
He took them off and peered myopically at his friend.
"What happiness to see you! What joy to find a Christian in this barbarous land!
You are just come out of the hospital, I find.
Yes, indeed. One of my people, I am surgeon of the Three Graces, has what looks to me very like the Marthambles, and I wished to isolate him under proper care until it declares itself, rather than infect the whole ship. It is as deadly as measles or the smallpox to islanders, and we have many of them aboard. But no, they would not hear of it, so I went to see Mr. Raleigh, who had travelled out with us and who is a Roman, in case he could persuade them. He lectures on law at the university, an influential man. But no, no, and no. They gave him a bottle or two of excellent wine, as I dare say you noticed, but they would not yield. On the way from Lima, he told me that he did not expect to succeed, their memory of the buccaneers, the sacking of churches and so on being so very vivid, and he was right, I suppose. At all events, they do not choose to have anything to do with me or my patient. Then I am afraid my case is hopeless, for my patient is not only a Protestant, but a clergyman too. Come and drink a cup of coffee with me. I shall be very happy, but your case would have been hopeless had he been the Pope. The place is so low and airless and fetid, the numbers so great and indiscriminately heaped upon one another, that they would never have left your parson there. Geary and Maturin had studied medicine together. They had shared a skeleton and several unclaimed victims of the Liffey or the Seine. Now, as they sat in the shade, drinking coffee, they spoke with the uninhibited directness of medical men. "My patient," said Stephen, "is also my assistant. He was as devoted to natural philosophy as you, particularly to birds, and although he had followed no regular course, attended no lectures, walked no wards, he became a useful surgeon's mate by constant attendance in the sick berth and frequent dissection. And since he was a well-read, cultivated man, he was also an agreeable companion." Unhappily, he recently came to suspect that he had contracted a venereal disease, and when, during an exceptionally long period without fresh water to wash our clothes, he developed salt sores, he thought his suspicions were confirmed. It is true that his mind was very much perturbed at the time, for reasons that it would be tedious to relate and almost impossible to convey. The distress of jealousy, imagined ill usage and homesickness entered into it, and that his lesions were far more important than any I have seen at any time. Yet even so, how a man of his experience could persuade himself that they were syphilitic, I cannot tell. But persuaded he was, and he dosed himself privately with calomel and guaiacum. Naturally enough, these had no effect, so he took to the corrosive sublimate. "Corrosive sublimate?" cried Geary.
"Yes, sir," said Stephen, "and in such amounts that I hesitate to name them. He brought himself very low indeed before he told me. Our relations were by then far from cordial, though there remained a deep, latent affection. Fresh water, the proper lotions, and a conviction that he was not diseased have improved the state of his skin remarkably, but the effects of this intolerable deal of sublimate remains. Young gentlewoman," he called towards the dim recesses of the wine shop, "be so good as to prepare me a ball of coca leaves."
"With lime, sir?"
"By all means, and a trifle of lipta, too, if you have it."
"What are the symptoms at this point?" asked Geary.
"Strongly marked vertigo, perhaps aggravated by the loss of an eye some years ago. Difficulty in following the sequence of letters. Some degree of mental confusion and distress. Great physical weakness, of course. A most irregular pulse. Chaotic defecation. Thank you, my dear." This to the girl with the coca leaves.
They carried on with Martin's present state, and when Stephen had said all that occurred to him without reference to his notes, Geary asked, "Is there on the one hand a difficulty in telling right from left, and on the other a certain loss of hair?"
"There is," said Stephen.
He stopped chewing and looked attentively at his friend.
"I have known two similar cases, and in Vienna itself I heard of several more."
"Did you hear of cures at all?"
"Certainly. Both my men walked away from the hospital unaided. One quite well, the other with only a slight impediment, though in his case there had been a baldness of the entire person and loss of nails, which Birnbaum cites as the criterion. But the treatment was long and delicate. What do you intend to do with your patient?"
"I am at a loss. My ship is about to be docked, and he cannot remain aboard. I had hoped to find him a room in the hospital, until I could arrange for his passage home in a merchantman. We may cruise for a great while, and in any case a privateer is no place for an invalid. Perhaps Lima."
Stephen fell silent.
"When you speak of a passage," said Geary,
I presume the gentleman is not the usual indigent surgeon's mate?
Never in life. He is an Anglican clergyman with two livings, and he has done well in prize money. If you were to look into the bay, you would see two captured ships, a clearly determined share of which belongs to him.
I say this only because our captain, a paragon of nautical virtue and of many others, is answerable to his owners, insatiable men who know nothing of charity or goodwill. Yet since there is no question of either, why does not your patient sail in the Three Graces? We have two empty staterooms amidships, and she is a remarkably steady ship.
This is very precipitate, Francis Geary, said Stephen.
So it is, replied Geary, but the voyage itself will be tranquil and deliberate. Captain Hill very rarely spreads royals. We are to touch at Iquique and Valparaiso, and perhaps at another port in Chile.
So many pauses for refreshment on shore, and we are to prepare ourselves at the entrance to the Magellan Straits at the very best time of the year for the eastward passage. Captain Hill does not choose to risk his owner's spars off the Horn. Furthermore, he is an acknowledged expert on the intricate navigation of the channel, has threaded it again and again. It would be infinitely more suitable for a man in a delicate state of health. Will you not come with me and look at the ship?
If you please, sir, said Jemmy Ducks, the tide is on the turn, which we ought to shove off directly.
Jemmy Ducks, said Stephen, when you have drank a moderate dram, you shove off by yourself. I'm going to walk to the dockyard to see the Liverpool ship.
My dear love to you, sir, said Jemmy Ducks, lowering a quarter of a pint of Peruvian brandy without a wink. And my duty to the gentleman.
As they walked back from the tall headland from which they had waved to the Three Graces for a great while as she sailed away into the southwest, Stephen, Perdine, and the little girls were low in their spirits, mute. It was not that the tropical day was oppressive, for an agreeable breeze blew in from the sea, but the dry, hard, pale yellow ground underfoot had nothing whatsoever growing on it, no life of any kind, and the arid sterility had a saddening effect on minds already disappointed. The distance to their lofty cliff had been greater than they thought, their pace slower. The Liverpool ship was already clear of the coast by the time they got there, and even with Stephen's spyglass they could not be sure they had seen Martin, though he had gone aboard with no more than a hand to help him over the gangway and had promised to sit there by the taffrail. In silence they walked, therefore, with the ocean on their left and the Andes on their right, both admittedly majestic, indeed sublime, but perhaps beyond all human measure, at least to those who were sad, hungry, and intolerably dry. And it was not until their stark plateau fell abruptly away, showing the green valley of the Rimac far below, with Lima apparently quite close at hand, sharply defined by its walls, and in the other direction, Callao, the busy port, the dockyard, and the exactly squared town, that they came to sudden cheerful life, calling out to one another, "There is Lima! There is Callao! There is the ship! Poor thing!" For to their astonishment she was already in the yard, stripped to the gantline and partially heaved down.
"And there!" cried Sarah, pointing to the shipping along the mole. "There is the Franklin's handmaiden!"
"You mean tender," said Emily.
"Jemmy Duck says handmaiden," replied Sarah.
"Sir, sir," cried Emily, "she means the Alistair's big schooner-rigged launch lying there next to the Mexico ship."
"With the barquay all sideways, will there ever be tea?"
asked Perdine, with quite extraordinary fluency for him.
"There will certainly be tea," said Stephen, and he stepped forward briskly to the path winding down the slope. He was mistaken, however. The surprise was in far too much of a hullabaloo for any form of quiet enjoyment. The word that she might be heaved down without waiting for her turn had reached Tom Pullings only after Stephen set out, and he and the carpenter and the only valid boatswain's mate were already as busy as bees among the port's stores of copper, cordage, ship's timber and paint, with Jack's words,
"Spend and spare not,"
in their ears, when the launch appeared, sent in to carry out a large number of men for the short-handed Franklin.
"We had foreseen it, in course," said Pullings, receiving Stephen on the sloping deck. "The captain would not have had enough people to send a prize in else, but it came at an awkward moment before we could arrange for a gang of dockyard mateys. As soon as I heard we could dock well before our time, I hauled alongside the Alistair and shifted all your things and a sick berth into her, and then when we were in dock and barely half-stripped, the launch brought her orders and everything had to be changed. She also brought a hand by the name of Fabian, who belonged to the Franklin, and who helped Mr. Martin when he was aboard.
The captain had meant to send him across before we parted company, but he forgot.
"Oh, doctor," he cried, striking his forehead. "Here am I, forgetting likewise. When we were all ahoo, a clergyman came aboard, the same that we saw on the way out. The gentleman very like the captain, only rather darker. He had heard the captain was wounded, was much concerned, inquired for you, said he would come again at noon tomorrow, begged for paper and ink, and left you this note."
"Thank you, Tom," said Stephen. "I shall read it aboard the Alistair. May I beg for a boat? And perhaps the man the captain sent might come with us." In the Alistair's great cabin, now thoroughly clean at last and smelling only of seawater, tar and fresh paint, there had been a truly shocking carnage, Stephen sat drawing in sips of scalding tea, a tea he ordinarily despised, though not as much as he despised Grimshaw's coffee, but one that he found comforting after the high Peruvian desert. And as he did so, he re-read the note.
"My dear sir, when I came back from a retreat with Benedictines of Huange last night, I heard that the surprise had put into Callao once more, and I had great hopes of news of you and of Captain Aubrey. But on sending to your agent in the morning, it appeared that although he had indeed been aboard her, he was now in the captured American privateer Franklin. At the same time, to my consternation, I learnt that he had been wounded in taking the infamous Alistair. I hurried down to the port at once, where Captain Pullings reassured me to some degree, and told me of your very welcome presence. I propose, therefore, to do myself the honour of waiting on you at noon tomorrow to assure you that I remain, dear sir, your most humble, obliged, and obedient servant, Sam Panda."
Neither Jack nor Sam acknowledged the relationship in so many words, but it was clearly understood by both, as it was by all those members of the crew who had first seen the younger man come aboard the Surprise in the West Indies. It was indeed obvious to anyone who saw them together, for Sam, born by a Bantu girl after Jack had left the Cape Station, was an ebony-black version of his father, somewhat larger, if anything. Yet there were differences. Jack Aubrey neither looked nor sounded sharply intelligent unless he were handling a ship, fighting a battle, or speaking of navigation. In fact, he also possessed uncommon mathematical powers and had read papers on nutation to the Royal Society, but this did not appear in his ordinary conversation. Sam, on the other hand, had been brought up by singularly learned Irish missionaries. His command of languages, ancient and modern, did the father's infinite credit, and he had read voraciously. Stephen, a Catholic himself, with a certain amount of influence in Rome, had procured him the dispensation necessary for a bastard to be ordained priest, and now Sam was doing remarkably well in the church. It was said that he might soon become a prelate, not only because at present there were no black monsignori, some yellowish or quite dark brown, to be sure, but none of such a whole-hearted, gleaming black as Sam, but also because of his patristic learning and his exceptional and evident abilities. "I look forward to seeing him," said Stephen, and after a pause in which he drank yet another cup of tea, "I believe I shall walk along the road to Lima and meet him halfway. Who knows but what I may see a condor?" He hailed William Grimshaw, Killick's mate, who had been detached to look after him, in spite of the fact that Tom Pullings had a perfectly good steward of his own. "William Grimshaw," he said, "pray desire the Franklin the captain sent to step below." And when the Franklin appeared, a tall, thin, nervous young man with receding hair, he went on, "Fabian, sit down on that locker. I understand you were an apothecary's assistant in New Orleans, but first tell me which language you speak more readily."
"They are much the same, sir," said Fabian. "I was apprenticed to a horse leech in Charleston when I was a boy."
"Very well. Now I understand you helped Mr. Martin when he was aboard your ship."
"Yes, sir. Since the surgeon and his mate were both killed, I was all he could find."
"But I am sure you were very useful to him, with your experience as an apothecary. Indeed, I seem to remember his mentioning you with commendation before he grew so ill."
"It did not amount to much, sir. Most of my time in the shop I spent skinning or stuffing birds or drawing them or colouring plates. Yet I did learn to make up the usual prescriptions, a blue and black draught, and I did help Monsieur Duvalier in his practice. Just the simple things."
"In New Orleans, is it customary for apothecaries to stuff birds?"
"No, sir. Some like to have rattlers in the window or a baby in spirits, but we were the only one with birds. Monsieur Duvalier had a school friend who engraved them, and he wanted to compete with him, so when he found me drawing a turkey buzzard and then setting it up, he offered me a place."
The horse leech's calling did not please you?
Well, sir, he had a daughter.
Ah, Stephen made himself a ball of leaves and said, no doubt you were well acquainted with the birds of your country?
I read what I could find to read, Bartram, Pennant, and Barton, but it did not amount to much, yet still and all.
Smiling,
I reckon I had an egg and some feathers of every bird that nested within 20 miles of New Orleans or Charleston, and drawings of them.
That must have interested Mr. Martin.
Fabian's smile left him.
They did at first, sir, he said, but then he seemed not to care.
The drawings were not very good, I guess.
Monsieur Audubon took little notice of them, said they were not lively enough, and Monsieur Cuvier never answered when my master sent two or three he had touched up.
I should like to see some when we are at leisure, but at present I still have a few patients in the sick berth. My engagements may take me away from the ship, and until I have made proper arrangements for them on shore, I should like to leave a man aboard to whom I can send instructions. There are no longer any urgent cases. It is a matter of changing dressings and administering physic at stated intervals. I have an excellent loblolly boy, but although he understands English quite well, he speaks little, and all the less in that he has a severe stammer, and he can neither read nor write. On the other hand, he has a great gift for nursing, and he is much loved by the people. I should add that he is enormously strong, and although mansuetude, although gentleness is written on his face, he is capable of terrible rage if he is provoked. To offend him, and thus to offend his friends, in a ship like this would be mortal folly. Come with me till I show you our sick berth. There are only 3 amputations left, and they are in a very fair way. They will need dressing for a week or two more, and some physic and lotions written on a sheet with their times. You will meet Padin there, and I am sure you will conciliate his goodwill.
I certainly shall, sir. Anything for a quiet life is my motto.
And yet you were in a privateer.
Yes, sir. I was running away from a young woman. The same as when I left the Charleston horse leech.
The road to Lima ran between great irrigated mud-walled fields of sugarcane, cotton, alfalfa, Indian corn, and past carob groves with here and there bananas, oranges, and lemons in all their variety, and where the sides of the valley rose, some distant vines. At times it followed the deep-cut bank of the Rimac, now a fine, great, roaring torrent from the snows that could be seen a great way off. And here were palms, strangely interspersed with fine, great willows of a kind Stephen had not seen before. Few birds, apart from an elegant tern that patrolled the quieter side pools of the river, and few flowers. This was the dry season of the year, and except where the innumerable irrigation channels flowed, nothing but a grey, wiry grass was to be seen. There was a good deal of traffic, casks and bales travelling up from the port or down to it in ox or mule-drawn wagons that brought the Spain of his youth vividly to mind. The same high-crested yokes, the same crimson, brass-studded harness, the same ponderous, creaking wheels. Some few horsemen, some people sitting on asses, more going by foot. Short, strong Indians with grave or expressionless copper faces, sometimes bowed under enormous burdens. Some rare Spaniards, many black Africans, and every possible combination of the three, together with additions from visiting ships. All these people called out a greeting as they passed, or told him that
it was dry, dry, intolerably dry,
all except the Indians, who went by mute, unsmiling. It was Stephen's custom, particularly when he was walking in a flat country, to turn his face to the zenith every furlong or so, in order not to miss birds soaring above the ordinary range of vision. When he had been walking for an hour, he did this again, after a longer pause than usual, and to his infinite delight he saw no less than 12 condors wheeling and wheeling high in the pale sky between him and Lima. He walked a few paces more, sat on a milestone, and fixed them with his pocket-glass. No possibility of error. Enormous birds. Not perhaps as wide as the wandering albatross, but more massive by far, a different kind of flight, a different use of the air entirely. Perfect flight, perfect curves, never a movement of those great wings. Round and round, rising and falling, rising and rising still, until at the top of their spiral they glided away in a long, straight line towards the northeast. He walked on with a smile of pure happiness on his face, and presently, just after he had passed a posada where carts and wagons stood under the shade of carob trees while their drivers drank and rested, he felt his smile return of its own accord. There on the road ahead was a tall black horse carrying a taller, blacker rider at a fine easy trot towards Callao. At the same moment the trot changed to a brisk canter, and a yard from Stephen, Sam leapt from the saddle, his own smile still broader. They embraced and walked slowly along, each asking the other how he did, the horse gazing into their faces with some curiosity.
"But tell me, sir, how is the captain?"
"His main being is well, thanks be to God."
"Thanks be to God."
"But he had the wad of a pistol in his eye. The bullet itself rebounded from his skull, a certain concussion, a certain passing forgetfulness, no more. But the wad set up an inflammation that had not yet quite yielded to treatment by the time I left him, by the time he ordered me to leave him, and he had a pike thrust in the upper part of his thigh that is probably healed by now, though I wish I could be assured of it. But before I forget, he sends his love, says he hopes to bring the Franklin, his present ship, into Callao quite soon, and trusts that you will dine with him."
"Oh, how I hope we shall see him well," cried Sam.
And after a moment,
"But, my dear sir, will you not mount? I will hold the stirrup for you. He is a quiet, gentle horse, with an easy walk on him."
"I will not," said Stephen, "though he is the dear kind of creature, I am sure," stroking the horse's nose. "Listen, there is a little small shebeen 2 minutes back along the road. If you're not desperate for time, let you put him up in the shelter there and return to Callao with me. There is nothing to touch walking for conversation. Reflect upon it, my dear. Me perched up on this high horse, and he is 17 hands if he is an inch, calling down to you, and yourself looking up all the while, like Toby listening to the Archangel Raphael. Edifying, sure, but it would never do."
Sam left not only his horse, but his black clerical hat, disagreeably hot through the beaver with the sun reaching its height, and they walked along with an agreeable ease.
"There is another thing that the captain wished to speak to you about," said Stephen. "Among other prizes we took a pirate, the Alastor. She is in the port at this moment. Most of her crew were killed in the desperate fighting. It was in this battle that the captain was hurt, and Captain Pullings has delivered those who were not to the authorities here. But she also had a few seamen prisoners whom we have set free to go ashore or stay, as they please, and a dozen African slaves, the property, if I may use the word, of the pirates. They were shut up below, and they took no part in the fighting. There is no question of their being sold to increase our people's prize money, since the most influential men in our crew, deeply religious men, are abolitionists, and they carry the others with them."
"Bless them."
"Bless them indeed. But the captain does not like to turn the black men ashore. He fears they may be taken up and reduced to servitude again, and although he does not feel so strongly about slaves as I do, it is one of the few points on which we differ, he is of opinion that having sailed for even so short a time under the British flag, they, ipso facto, became free, and that it would be an injustice to deprive them of their liberty. He would value your advice."
"I honour him for his care of them. Properly vouched for, they may certainly live here in freedom. Have they a trade, after all?"
"They were being carried from one French sugar plantation to another when their vessel was taken. As far as I can make out, their French amounts to a few words, no more. That is all the work they understand."
"We can find them places here, easily enough," said Sam, waving towards a sea of green cane. "But it is hard work and ill paid. Would the captain not consider keeping them aboard?"
"He would not. We have only able seamen or highly skilled tradesmen, the sailmakers, coopers, armourers, and landsmen could never be countenanced in such a vessel as ours. Yet surely even a low wage with freedom is better than no wage and lifelong slavery."
"Anything at all is better than slavery,"
cried Sam, with a surprising degree of passion in so large and calm a man.
"Anything at all. Wandering diseased and three parts starved in the mountains, roasted, frozen, naked, hunted by dogs like the wretched Maroons I sought out in Jamaica."
"You too feel very strongly about slavery?"
"Oh, indeed, and indeed I do. The West Indies were bad enough, but Brazil was worse by far. As you know, I worked for what seemed an eternity among the black slaves there."
"I remember it well. That was one of the many reasons that I looked forward so to seeing you again in Peru."
He looked attentively at Sam.
But Sam's mind was still in Brazil, and in his deep voice, deeper than Jack's, he went on,
"There may be a tolerable domestic slavery. Who has not seen something like it in slave countries? But the temptation is always there, the possibility of excess, the latent tyranny, the latent servility. And who is fit to be continually exposed to temptation? On the other hand, it seems to me that there is no possibility whatsoever of a tolerable industrial slavery. It rots both sides wholly away. The Portuguese are a kindly, amiable nation, but in their plantations and mines—"
After a while, the road flowing past them and the river on the right-hand side, Sam checked abruptly, and in a hesitant, faltering tone he said,
"Dear doctor, sir, pray forgive me. Here am I prating away for ever and in a loud voice to you, a man that might be my father. Sure you know all this better than I do, and have reflected on it since before ever I was born. Shame on my head."
"Not at all, not at all, Sam. I have not a tenth part of your experience, but I know enough to be sure that slavery is totally evil. The early generous revolution in the France of my youth abolished it. Bonaparte brought it back, and he is an evil man. His system is an evil system. Tell me, does the Archbishop feel as you do?"
"His Grace is a very ancient gentleman, but the Vicar General, Father O'Higgins, does."
"Many of my friends in Ireland and England are abolitionists," observed Stephen, deciding to go no farther at this point. "I believe I can make out the Alastor among the shipping to the left of the Dominican church. She is painted black, and she has four masts. That is where we live while the surprise is being repaired. Her knees cause some anxiety, I understand. I look forward to presenting my little girls to you, Sarah and Emily, who are good, well, fairly good Catholics, though they have barely seen the inside of a church. To showing you the captain's unhappy, bewildered, half-liberated black men, and to asking your help in housing my patients, if the prize is sold from under them before they are quite well. And Sam," he went on as they entered Callejo, "at some later time, when you are free, I should very much like to talk to you about the state of public opinion here in Peru, not only about abolition, but about many other things, such as freedom of commerce, representation, independence, and the like."